You're listening to the Everyday Athlete Podcast, Episode 8, the podcast for everyday athletes everywhere, in association with 97 Display.
Welcome to the Everyday Athlete, the podcast for everyday athletes everywhere. You're now part of an exciting movement of adventurous everyday athletes who want to train smarter and live to 100 years old. Now, here's your host, Josh Kennedy.
And welcome to the Everyday Athlete Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Kennedy. It's great to make you part of a growing community trying to change the world through health and fitness, who like to train differently, train smarter, and live a healthy and fulfilling lifestyle. If you want to take a step away from the mainstream, this podcast will give you an insight into the daily life of an everyday athlete, and we look forward to you joining us. Thank you so much for tuning in once again. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. It is great to have you all here. Before I introduce today's guest, I just want to say, for those of you out there listening in who are doing the 21-day Everyday Athlete Challenge, I really hope it's going well, guys. Hope you're enjoying it, and I hope your skipping technique is improving as much as mine is. If you don't know anything about the Everyday Athlete, 21-day Everyday Athlete Challenge, get yourself onto the Strength Matters Facebook page and check it out. We will be running more in the future. So in today's episode, I talk to sprinting ninja Fran Schneiderman from Revolution Fitness in La Jolla, really switched on guy, a great friend. We talk all about intentional athleticism, sprinting, and tons more besides. And as I give him a little lightning quiz on sprinting at the end, which for my liking, he is far too good at. And my guest today is a former collegiate sprinter, power and speed aficionado. I love that word, aficionado. He's the owner of Revolution Fitness in La Jolla, San Diego, and co-creator of Primal Speed. He's a hardstyle kettlebell lover and senior SMK instructor with Strength Matters, who dreams of being a superhero and sprinting ninja, which is very appropriate, as the first time I met him in London a few years ago, he showed me a fantastic little video of him sprinting inside a little red telephone box, which we will talk about later on, I'm sure, which of course a red phone box is the occasional superhero's changing room of choice. It is Franz Schneiderman. Franz, welcome to the Everyday Athlete Podcast, mate. How are you doing?
I'm great, Josh. Thank you for having me. Excited to be on this new awesome podcast. Can't wait.
I hope it's awesome. We haven't actually released any, as we're recording this, we've released no episodes, so we'll see. I'm sure it'll be absolutely fine though. Let's not worry about it.
Yeah. I'm optimistic it will be.
I hope so. I hope so. What's the weather like today with you? Hot?
I'm very jealous. I think it's let's see. I think it's going to be 85 degrees today, and over the weekend it's going to be like 86. So it's going to be super nice. That's a little warm for April, but I'm okay with it.
I feel so sorry for you.
I'm sure you do.
Drowning my sorrows with my small glass of red wine right now.
That's good.
That's how we're going to roll on today's podcast, I'm afraid.
Fine with me. I'll get out my single malt scotch, my Glenfiddich 18, and we'll get going.
Nice. Crack. It might be a little bit early for you, friends, at the moment, but hell.
No. I don't have it. Darn it.
Damn it. See, there you go. There's your first mistake, not having your scotch next to you.
Exactly.
Sure.
Exactly.
Usually I accompany a podcast with a cup of tea, but you know, it's Friday night when I'm recording this, so I thought, you know, screw it. Just go with the red wine.
No judgment here, brother. No judgment here.
Right. Let's crack straight on. In case people don't know who you are or what you do, could you just tell us a little bit more background about yourself and how you got into sprinting?
Sure. Yeah. I'm a 21-year veteran of the fitness industry. I've been a personal trainer since 1996. And I've done a lot. And I think, I'm kind of known now more as like the sprinting guy, because I'm trying to take the concept of power training in general and sprinting as just a very intelligent means of exercise for the masses. And I think that's what's kind of unique about my message, is that I'm not just going after the athletes, but I basically had my beginnings were in track and field in high school. I played basketball, played soccer, but I basically stumbled into track and field by accident. I had a track coach who asked me to come out in high school. He saw me playing soccer, thought I was pretty fast. Didn't really know that I was fast, but long story short, I went out. I did very well. Ended up getting a scholarship for college, and I ran some college track, and pretty much have been a sprinting track and field like nerd geek And at 43, I mean, I'm more into it now. And, you know, I love coaching just everybody on how to be more powerful. And, you know, it's really kind of my life's work is to keep that power alive in everybody.
Mm, which is incredibly important as we age as athletes.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So tell me about Primal Speed. How did that come about? How did people find out more about it? What is it? All of that.
Yeah. Well, sure. It's a Primal Speed is kind of the brainchild of my brother and me. I have a twin brother named Keith Snyben, who's not as involved in the company at the moment because he's finishing physical therapy school. So I've basically kind of taken it over. But it's basically over 21 years, like a synthesis of all of my training, my experience, my knowledge in track and field, strength and conditioning, kettlebell training, health and performance. It's basically that synthesized into a system that teaches people not only sprinting, but just power training in general, with sprinting being like our main tool. And it's 21 years in the trenches of what has worked and what has empirically made people better, healthier, less resistant to, more resistant to injury. And it's, I'm very proud of the system. It's an evolving system, but it's a system that I think is unique in the kind of the power and speed industry, because it is geared towards health first and performance next. Where I think most speed and power type of training and companies, which I not talking about anybody. I mean, there's some amazing companies out there, but to my knowledge, there's nothing out there like Primal Speed, which is geared towards looking at sprinting as kind of the top of the food chain as far as like human locomotion. So basically, everybody's pre-wired from birth to have that capacity. And genetically, we all have that capacity. We just don't use it, and we've kind of lost it. And my thinking and my experience is that as you get older, you actually need more power. And I'm just crazy enough to think that, like, I'm just asking some fun questions, like, why don't we just do power our whole lives? Like, why don't we just do it till the day we die? Like, there should be you should not experience a decade of life where you just completely decay. You can't jump. You can't run. You go on a walker. Like, that shouldn't happen. I mean, barring like an accident or something, like if you keep it in your training and you're intentional about keeping that biomotor quality alive, then all of the other motor qualities, strength, endurance, speed, agility, coordination, balance, flexibility, they all get better. So the reason I pick sprinting, the reason I pick power as the master quality is that it makes all of the other biomotor qualities better. And you can't necessarily say that about like flexibility. Like, and I'm all for flexibility, but flexibility to a point is not going to make you more powerful.
When it's appropriate.
Exactly. Like you know, yoga masters that can tie themselves into pretzels don't win the 100 meter, right? they're too loose. So there's a time and a place for all the qualities, and how to balance that and synthesize that into a training program is completely different for each person. But one thing that I think every human being needs, without a doubt, is the ability to produce force quickly, and that's the goal, and that's how this was birthed.
Yes.
That's how Primal Speed came into being.
I mean, I've done a couple of your workshops, only like, you know, at 45 minute hour long, and they've been absolutely fantastic. Highly recommend people to go along to one of the Primal Speed workshops. But why is it you think people, as we age, we move away from the power and the sprint training and more into the endurance? Is it, I don't know, fear of injury, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that more has to do just with the society kind of expectations, and predominantly in Western societies, people get busy and, you know, everybody has bills to pay and kids to feed, and they really just, their lifestyle is not conducive to keeping power in anymore, unless you're intentional about it and you play sports. But most people, once they get into college or they get into a profession, it unfortunately, power training just becomes something that was something they used to do. Like, oh, well, I used to run track and field. Oh, I used to, you know, I used to play football. I used to play basketball. And it becomes a used to be. And it's the one motor quality that is really, it's the hardest to build, but it's the easiest to lose.
Yeah.
So every decade you remove yourself from that, you know, from participating in power, it becomes that much harder. And that's because the human body, the human organism, like any mammal, like any animal, is an adaptive being. It just adapts. So if you don't do any kind of power work, your tissues, you know, they adapt to not doing that. So they everything on a cellular level up to your fascia and connective tissue, your tendons, they're not fit for power-like work. So yes, it does become kind of a safety issue if you take a total like couch potato who just doesn't move, and all of a sudden you say, you know, let's go run 400-meter dash, and they're going to get injured.
Yeah,
they don't have the adaptation, but it doesn't need to be that way. Even a little bit of power training long-term will completely, you know, you will get a different adaptation. But yeah, I think there's many reasons why, one of them just being life and work and Western society and technology. I mean, frankly, you don't need to sprint to catch your food anymore. You're not going to die. You know, you can get food on every corner, at least here in San Diego. And I know in London, you can get food everywhere. So
you can.
We don't need to. Exactly. That's why.
Yeah, absolutely. I think my flatmates are ordering off Just Eat, I think, tonight. So they're not going to be doing any sprinting to catch that food. So let's start convincing people to introduce this power and sprint training back into their training regime. So if somebody does want to do that, does want to get back into sprinting, where should they start, mate, and what are the building blocks?
Well, I think those are excellent questions, and I think it really depends kind of on where on the start point of each person and each athlete. So I'm going to kind of answer this question for like the person that really is not like an ex-track and field athlete, just like the average person goes to the gym, kind of a fitness enthusiast who just wants to be the better version of themselves, not necessarily going to athletics. So perfect. From that perspective, I have a couple of ideas. So first one is that person basically needs to start with sprinting mechanics, which in a nutshell is basically you just take the sprinting cycle or the gait cycle. And I think most people can agree that sprinting is just the higher end of gait. Like walking, you have crawling on one end and on the other end of the continuum of sprinting. But it's all basically, you know, hand leg opposite movement. Your one leg's moving forward, one leg's moving back, one arm's moving forward, one arm's moving back. And the core in the middle just kind of stabilizes that and transfers the energy. So it really, people are already walking. So sprinting is it's just the higher end. So where I usually start people is I start people off with something as simple as marching. You know, can they just lift their foot a little bit higher off the ground? And then from marching, we'll go to skipping, and then eventually we'll go kind of to running in place, which is called a running A. And then from there, there's a host of other drills. But the first thing to do, and most important, as within any movement, is mechanical efficiency. So if you start people off with just the notion of lifting their foot off the ground a little faster and making sure that they're lifting the foot high enough to pre-stretch the glutes and the hamstrings, because the higher the foot goes off the ground, the more of a stretching sensation, the more of an actual stretch there is in the connective tissue, that's where the power comes from sprinting. But we start slow, then eventually we increase the velocity of the limb movements, and then eventually they get into like kind of running, and then eventually kind of a slow sprint, and eventually sprinting. But there is kind of a gradual increase in that. So marching would be one, and then number two would be arm mechanics. I get people to just move their arms explosively from the shoulder independent of their legs. So this really helps with motor learning, because in sprinting, in distance running, you don't really need like crazy powerful range of motion or power in your shoulders, because you're just not generating the force. In sprinting, you do.
Yeah.
So we'll isolate the arms out of the legs and just have people sit on like on the ground and just learn to move the shoulders. They can literally do arm mechanics for, you know, 60 seconds, 30 seconds at a time, and then eventually go to kneeling, like half kneeling on one knee, and then eventually standing. And then you start integrating that back with the marching. So then people are learning to coordinate the arms with the legs, which is just like it's like gait on steroids. And then from there, you gradually increase the velocity and the distance. So really, if you're patient with people and you kind of meet them where they're at, I can get a 78-year-old sprinting, you know, assuming that they don't have like a fake knee or a fake hip, within 3 to 6 months, they're actually motoring down the track doing their version of sprinting. So it can be very safe. But like anything, you know, it's like it's kind of like a gun, right? You don't like give somebody a gun the first time and tell them to shoot it. You teach them how to use it. Mm. You teach them the proper movement. And in sprinting, mechanical efficiency is everything. So we just we pre-wire that right from the beginning so that their landing mechanics are good. And then over time they adapt. Right? It's all about adaptation.
Yep.
Any kind of result you want in anything, whether you want to be a power lifter, you want to get into Olympic lifting or strongman training, whatever, if you do it consistently enough and you do it well enough, your body will adapt. It's an amazing thing. And you'll start to rewire the brain with this skill of sprinting. And that's where this is a skill. Mm-hmm. Movement is a skill. Sprinting is a skill. It's something that you can learn. So with Primal Speed in my workshops, and I have an online program called the Primal Speed Sprinting Tribe that is about to launch, actually, which is going to be really cool. It gives people the opportunity to do video tutorials. They can get weekly programming, monthly templates on how to program in their strength, their mobility, their conditioning with sprinting. And I'm very excited about that. But I'm just more excited to just share kind of this passion for sprinting, because it really is – it's kind of a natural birthright, and I don't expect everybody to become a track and field sprinter, but certainly it would be nice if there was just a lot more sprinting groups out there and we just saw people sprinting. I mean, not to mention the hormonal and the health benefits. Like, I don't know if you've ever looked at a sprinter. Obviously, you have. They're pretty darn lean, and they move really well.
Absolutely. I mean, we'll dig deeper into the hormonal and health benefits in a sec, but I just wanted to talk about, you mentioned just something as simple as sitting on the floor, taking the legs out of the equation, just working those arm mechanics, you know, like really driving the elbow back, if I remember rightly, getting your thumb up in front of your nose so you can see it, getting a bit of wind between your fingers. And even just doing that, especially for someone who's, you know, not particularly conditioned, that's a workout in itself.
Oh, big time. Oh, absolutely. Because when you take your legs out of it, all of a sudden you have nothing to kind of counteract the movement of your arms. And most people aren't used to explosively using their shoulders, like, you know, where you're bringing your hand up to about eye level, maybe about 5 to 6 inches in front of your face. And then you're whipping that hand in back of you and then, you know, kind of opening up that elbow and back. And I mean, people just don't do that. And when you add speed to that, it really becomes a resistance. So that intention of powerfully using that range of motion that you have in the shoulder, for most people, you're right, it is a workout. But from a neurologic standpoint, we're really you're really encouraging the shoulders to become part of the equation. Because even though the hip is where most of the power is generated, that is where like most of the power generated in sprinting and in most human movement, the shoulder in sprinting, there's a lot of power generated from that. So all good sprinters, one thing they have in common, other than, you know, they're mechanically efficient, is that they powerfully use their shoulders. Mm. So it's something that I don't think is emphasized enough, but if you really get people just doing that every, you know, a little bit every day, or at least every time they train, within 3 to 5 to 6 months, it's like their shoulders are so wired to get involved in movement that now it's just like it's like adding 50 extra horsepower to your car. I don't know if you guys use horsepower there too, right? I'm sure you do. Yep. So yeah, horsepower. If you've got these upper body muscles, those shoulders are connected via your fascia and muscles to your hips, right? Like think of a big X. Your left shoulder goes to your right hip and vice versa. So the more you use your hip, the more potential you have in the shoulder and vice versa. So it really gets fun when you see people get confident and they start to say, holy cow, I was really intimidated by the thought of sprinting. And I think for most people, let's be honest, that's a big hindrance to people getting into sprinting, is they say, oh, that's not for me.
Yeah.
That just looks a little too violent. It looks a little too ballistic. But Josh, if you break it down to the smaller components and then you piece it back together, you take a lot of the mystery out of it and you take a lot of the complication out of it.
Yeah, definitely.
And then you just start to encourage that we are one system. And then you get everything moving together, and there really isn't anybody that can't learn it. You just have to be patient with people, and you just have to make sure that you start at the right place. But working the arms is paramount.
Yeah, it's essential. You can get some serious bounce on that drill. It's really good.
Yeah. When you flex your shoulder, when your hand comes up, if you're using the range of motion you have, that forward flexion of the hand and shoulder coming up, it's gonna give you a little bit of undulation where you literally start to bounce off the floor. So people that do it powerfully, you'll start to see them bounce off the floor, right? So they'll get that nice little pop, pop, pop. And that's important because when you're sprinting, as the arm and shoulder comes up explosively, not only does it pre-stretch the back of the shoulder and get it ready for the arm to go back into extension, the lifting of the hand up lifts your pelvis up in the air. Think of jumping, right? When you want to jump in the air, you don't jump with your hands glued to your thighs. You shoot your arms up. What does that do? That helps give you lift. And if you can get the pelvis up in the air, then you have more time to actually stay in the air. What does that do? That generates more force. Why? Because you can flex your hip and it can actually be in a position where it can hit the ground from a higher position. Think of a hammer. If you have a nail and you only lift the hammer a quarter of an inch, it's just going to be hard to hit that nail into the piece of wood. But if you can lift it 5-6 inches higher, you've got a lot more vertical force that can hit the ground. So that's why the shoulders are so important, because they help you lift the pelvis a little higher off the ground, which does what? Think of the hammer analogy. It gives you more time to wind up those glute and hamstring muscles, which means you have more power. And we can trick people into learning that. That's just basic technique, yeah. Basic training.
I like that analogy. That's nice. The little hammer analogy. Good. You've never said that to me before, mate. Yeah, new stuff. Love it.
New stuff.
And when you get people sprinting, you know, people are like, oh my God, 100 meter sprint. I can't do that. But you don't do that, do you? You know, you're talking 30, 40, 40 meter dash, 40, you know, at the most, right?
Yeah. There's two different camps, especially in track and field. And I was kind of immersed into one camp and realized that it doesn't work. But I'll explain the camps. One camp is, one thought on how to train athletes is you start long, you get endurance first, and then as the season progresses, you bring the distances down, and then you gradually introduce speed. Okay? Mm-hmm. I'm in the other camp. I'm in the camp that's saying, well, if the number one goal is power and speed, then why would I prioritize endurance, which is going to basically just teach me to endure slowness? Why would I prioritize that if my main objective is speed and power? So I'm in the camp that says you start short. And there's been a lot of coaches that have had success with both. I think long-term people are going to realize that it makes sense to keep the short stuff in year-round. And then if you want endurance, you gradually add distance. But you develop speed and power first. If you have no speed, you have no power. What are you enduring, right? You're just getting good at running slow. So yeah, you start with 10 meters, 20 meters, 30 meters, maybe 40 meters max, 50 meters max. After about 40, 50 meters, people are at top speed. Most people can only hold max velocity speed for about 10 to 15 yards, and then everybody slows down. Even Usain Bolt and the best pros in the world. So if the goal is more power and the ability to kind of really produce force quickly, that's easier to do for 10 meters, 20 meters, 30 meters. Over time, as you develop speed, as you develop power, as you learn to accelerate, then we add endurance. And what I really like about that too is that it's hard to get injured doing 10s and 20s because you get up to top speed. Most of the injuries occur, they don't occur at 10 or 20. They occur 60, 70, 80 plus meters. When you're going pretty fast and you start to break down, that's where injuries occur. Yeah. So it sounds counterintuitive, but you actually need to start with the shorter distances. You don't start. And it's much safer to run 10s, 20s, and 30s than it is to run 60s, 70s, 80s, and 100 meters. And I'm not anti 100 meters. So,
but you got to build
that's
up to that.
Why we start people there. And most athletes and most people don't really need to be running hundreds and 200s unless they have a goal of competing in some competition or actually want to run the 100 meter and the 200 meter or the 400 meter. So most people need the ability of from about 6 to 15 steps. You know, if you're following the road and you need to get up, you need about 4 to 5 good steps. And that's where your 10s and 20s really come into place. You need that initial pop, that initial acceleration. That's where most of the training should be. And that's what and that's really what I address in my workshops and in my training is let's get your mechanical efficiency. And then when you're healthy enough and you understand enough when we start sprinting, we never sprint at 100%. We always sprint, you know, around 85 to 90%, maybe 92%. Then, yeah, then we start kind of getting into it. Only when you're safe enough, you know, when you've earned the right to start sprinting. But most people can start sprinting at least 10s, 20s, and 30s a lot sooner than they think they can.
Yeah.
And most people have governors in their brain that won't allow them to run fast anyway. They just have too much inhibition. So with most adults, they're running with the parking brakes on, including me. At 43, I feel like I'm running the parking brakes on. What we're trying to do is just get them to just take the parking brake off a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, and make the brain feel safe for them to move faster. So for most people, it's not even getting them to turn on the accelerator. It's getting them to turn the brake off. Because the brain, as you get older, cortical inhibition, as you get older, the body and the brain have experienced trauma. They've experienced heartache. You've just had more stuff happen in your life. The brain becomes more guarded.
Yeah.
It becomes a lot more guarded and says, I'm not going to let you run fast. So
like,
most people
down,
I don't
man.
Can't
what are
run
you doing?
Fast. Exactly. So my goal really is just to try to get them to turn, to allow their brain to accept the possibility that maybe they could run a little bit faster. Or a little bit faster. So the notion that it's going to be completely dangerous and it's like, most people can't run fast anyway. The danger comes when you're actually running pretty fast. Those are the worst injuries.
Yeah.
Because they're more violent.
Yeah. You start, you trip up and you go head over heel and there you go, you pop something. But I mean, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but even someone like, you know, Usain Bolt, in his training, he's not liable to run a full 100 meters that often. Wouldn't he be working more in 60s, 70s, 80s more often? And it may be less.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know exactly what his training, like what he does with his coaches, but I know for sure that, I mean, he definitely has times of the year where he's really focused just on his start and acceleration. He's not the strongest starter in the world. He's a decent starter. He's not the best starter. So his advantage.
Long legs. That's
yeah,
what
and, you know, and yeah, at past 40, from about 50 to 100 meters, he's pretty much unstoppable. He'll actually accelerate like from 50 to 70, which nobody does.
Wow.
I don't really think anybody does. So his advantage comes later on in the race.
Yeah,
but he produces so much force per stride that he almost doesn't need to have the best start in the world. Yeah, yeah. And it helps to be 6'5", right? It helps to be 6'5". It does.
I'm never.
He's an anomaly. He's an outlier. Yeah, that's okay. You can still be, if you're fast, you're fast. Doesn't really matter. You know, whatever you got to use.
Oh, well,
you got to dance with the girl you brought to the prom.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Well, I think I remember you complimenting me when I did your course saying my mechanics were pretty good. Pretty good. I'm never going to be
solid.
Usain Bolt, but I'm all right. So let's talk
You're
about...
pretty good.
Thank you, man. Let's talk about the benefits then of sprinting versus jogging and all those lovely hormonal health benefits.
Yeah, I think in general, all exercise is beneficial. I'm not a distance runner myself, but I'm not anti-distance running. I think it's a very good form of exercise. And the older I get, the more benefit I see in doing aerobic work. So I certainly don't want to anybody to think that I'm anti-aerobic work or conditioning. That's actually not true at all.
Mm-hmm.
Sprinters actually do some aerobic work because they have to, just for health and just to build their basic fitness levels. But we do it in a different format called tempo running, which I'll explain in a bit. But you know, both forms are great. But I think if we're going to talk about return on investment, there comes a point where going longer distances slower, the body becomes very efficient.
Yeah.
And the more efficient it becomes, the less fuel it burns. And for most people that are time strapped and they just don't have as much time to dedicate to training, my objective is to try to get them a means of training that maximizes results with minimal time input. And that's where I think sprinting is superior. Because, for example, if you're doing one of my short acceleration workouts, you know, maybe a 20 to 30 minute warm up and then 20 minutes of sprints. And most of that's spent resting. Like most of that time is spent resting. So if you're doing maybe 4 10 meter sprints with the minute rest, maybe 4 20s, 3 30s, and maybe 2 40 meters, you're roughly doing between 200 and 300 meters of total volume.
Mm.
That's not even a lap
yeah.
of a
yeah.
jog. around a track. However, the hormonal response is different. And the reason it's different is because when you attempt to move your body explosively, there are little signals in the brain going back and forth from the muscles and the spinal cord that say, oh my God, something different is happening. The adrenal glands kick in, a lot of pituitary gland kicks in, all these different glands kick in that say, wow, either we're going to eat or we're going to get eaten, because we haven't changed from an evolutionary perspective. That does several things in your body. It releases more testosterone. It releases more growth hormone, insulin growth factor 1, and all these other amazing hormones that tell the body to adapt to this stress, saying we cannot sprint fast if we have this much body fat on us. And if he's going to keep doing this, we better start producing those hormones to get rid of some of this fat so that we're more efficient and it's not as stressful on our body the next time. That's what adaptation is all about. So the adaptations of that intensity are amazing, because you look at distance runners. If you look at distance runners and sprinters, you know, elite level, they're really good. I mean, they both are lean, but the sprinters actually have lower body fat. So you say, wait a second, if most people's goal is to lose body fat, which that's always been my, I always want to lose fat. I want muscle and less fat. I think your goal is the same. I think everybody's goal is pretty much
the same.
We want muscle. Yeah. And we want less fat. So you have to look at the behaviors of people and the athletes, and you look at the results they're getting. You say, okay, well, most people just chase a body type, right? They say, well, I'm going to look like that. So they just say, I'm going to lose fat. And they just focus on the external goal. I think a better way of approaching this is, rather than chasing the body, and I actually said this at the recent Strength Matters Summit in San Diego when I gave a talk on intentional athleticism. Don't chase the body that you want. Chase the behavior that's going to give you the body, right? You look at a sprinter. Most people want to look like that, or they want to look something like that. They want to have muscle. They don't want to be huge, but they want muscle and they don't want fat.
Yeah.
Fine. You need to do behaviors and activities that are going to allow the body to get those adaptations. So if we know that that's the adaptation we want, eventually you've got to think more than just running or long walking or hiking. And that should be part of your program. There's nothing wrong with hiking and walking and aerobic work and rowing. I'm a fan of it. But by itself, you're going to stall out with that. You're not going to get the hormonal response unless your rowing or your hiking is intense.
Yeah.
There has to be an element of turbulence. And think of an airplane. An airplane's going along. You're flying into San Diego. All of a sudden, there's this turbulence. It's like, whoa, everybody gets awake and saying, holy crap, like, what's that? Sprinting is like turbulence. It shakes up the body. It shakes up the hormonal system, shakes up the metabolic rate. And it says, that was intense. Boom, whammo, all these chemicals go floating in the body, and you basically are, because of the behavior, there's a term we say called form follows function, right?
Yeah.
So the form, which is your body, is the byproduct of the function. So focus on the function. Do athletic things. Do explosive things. Look at explosive athletes that do explosive stuff. Volleyball players, basketball players, long jumpers, hurdlers. Like all the NBA players, they're all lean. You cannot do those activities and not have the form, which is your body, eventually have to listen and say, okay, I get it. I get what you're trying to get me to do. I will change. That's why you chase the behavior. Eventually the form or the body that you want will come. So that's why I say you're missing the boat. I mean, if you don't give this a shot, then, I mean, power training will change you.
Yeah.
It will help you build muscle. And especially for gym rats that live in the gym that are, you know, lifting and strong, they may be strong, but they're not necessarily powerful. You get them on the track, you increase their speed, you increase the brain's ability to communicate with these fast twitch muscle fibers, which don't really get built in, you know, from slow strength training. They go back in the gym and they're stronger. Like, oh my God, I'm blasting past a lot of these plateaus. Well, you've just changed your nervous system. You've just changed the neurology, because now you're accessing fibers that you don't get from a 10-second deadlift. And I'm not anti-deadlifting, but I am definitely pro doing explosive movements. So explosive, intense movements done intelligently are so essential. And not only just for obviously for body and body fat, just for health.
Absolutely.
Just keeping those pathways open for health and safety.
Yeah, totally. I mean, but I think it was it you wrote train. I don't know if it was you originally, but you know, train slow. You are slow. Train fast. You are fast, basically.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think I recently wrote that in a Facebook post. But that you know, if you, there's a strength coach for the Chicago Bulls for like two decades. His name was Al Vermeil, and he had a great quote that he always says. He says, "Listen, it's pretty simple. You know, your body adapts to what you do. Train slow, be slow. Train fast, you're gonna get fast. You're gonna get faster. So if you just always do slow strength training or slow movement, your body has no biological reason to keep those pathways open. You will lose those adaptations. You will lose those neural pathways. And then when you need to turn on the power and speed, it's just not going to be there. So just do a little bit. Always keep that in your training. And that's the goal of my company. The goal is to just get people to realize, like, hey, we're not saying this is the only thing to do. We're just saying you should be intentional about including it into your training.
Yeah.
Including absolutely. It into your program.
As you said, you're not anti-endurance or anything like that. We're just saying that that should be part of it and this should be part of your training. And you also say that sprint interval training can help reduce the risk of diabetes, which I think is absolutely fantastic because I've no doubt there are plenty of everyday athletes out there who suffer with diabetes. And is that true? It can help with that condition?
Yeah, I mean, it can pretty much help with any health condition. But, you know, when you burn through glucose or stored carbohydrate called glycogen, when you're in this glycolytic and ATP system, basically like 10 or 6 seconds or less, you're not really burning fat per se. You're burning through glycogen, which is great. Mm. Most people say, well, I'm not going to do sprinting because you're only burning stored carbohydrate. I'm like, that's true, but you're kind of missing the entire boat here is that the intense interval type of training, when you contract your muscles that hard and your brain and your body just eat up that glucose, you're improving. One of the adaptations that happens is that your body improves insulin sensitivity, which means that when the insulin gets to the muscle cell and has to kind of shuttle sugar over into the cell itself, sprinting, because when you burn through energy that fast, the body needs a more efficient system to say, oh my God, I need to make sure that next time that happens, that the transference from the blood, from the sugar in the bloodstream into my muscle cell is better. And that's kind of what diabetes is. They basically, they become insulin resistant, where insulin no longer does its job. Well, any kind of behavior or activity that encourages your muscle cells to behave better with insulin, where that relationship is better, and the insulin does a more efficient job of moving the sugar out of the blood into the muscle cell, is only going to benefit your health. So I would say there's a direct correlation between better insulin sensitivity and the way you process blood sugar from sprinting. Obviously, walking and endurance are going to do similar things, but I think sprinting is unique in the sense that it blows through stored glycogen so fast that one of the body's adaptive mechanisms there is to say, oh my God, like I better get even better disability. So yeah, there's a direct correlation. You get people sprinting and get them really, really good at sprinting and consistently sprinting, you're going to just see better. You're just going to see just your entire blood work may get better. I can't like guarantee that, but I guarantee you'll see some change in your blood sugar levels and your fasting glucose levels. I just think your body works better when you do those kind of intense explosive movements.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, in this day and age, unfortunately, when we do have a lot of lifestyle health related diseases, that's really important. So guys, get sprinting if you're not planning to already. Now, you mentioned it briefly before, your lovely term, which I think is absolutely fantastic, intentional athleticism. Franz, tell me what intentional athleticism is, mate.
Yeah, well, I love the word intentional because I think having intention in life in general is important. Intentional about your goals, intentional about maybe a family, just whatever is important to you in your life, it's because you have an intention. And my concept of intentional athleticism was basically just birthed out of my study of all motor qualities, where if you can think of the top eight motor qualities out there, and there's strength, endurance, coordination, flexibility, endurance, speed, power, balance. I think I said agility. If I didn't, agility.
I think so.
And yep. You look at all, yeah, so all of those motor qualities, we all possess them to one degree or another. And some of us are gifted genetically to be better at one. Like maybe somebody from Kenya genetically has the VO2 max gene. So they're probably going to be predisposed to be elite at endurance running because of birth, just because of the genes they have. Where somebody from Jamaica is going to be maybe more apt to be better at sprinting and power work and not at distance running because, again, different genetics. So we all have a different tendency to be better at some of the qualities. But intentional athleticism is taking an honest assessment of all of the qualities. And it's something as simple as you could write down all of those qualities on a piece of paper and say, okay, on a 1 to 10 scale. And I actually think this is a really good thing to do. I had all the students do this at the recent Strength Matters Summit. I say on a 1 to 10 scale, rate yourself from 1 to 10 on all of those motor qualities. Where are you on endurance? Where are you on strength? You know, think of Ed Cohn as like a 10 on strength. Where are you on power? Think of Usain Bolt or LeBron James. Are you a 5? Are you a 2? Are you an 8? And just give yourself an honest score and then start to see like, okay, well, I'm already a 9 or 10 on this. Is this where I should be spending most of my training? What if you have a 1 or 2? What if you're a 1 or 2 on mobility or you're a 1 on endurance and you have a hard time walking upstairs or you have high blood pressure? Intentional athleticism means, well, let's be intentional about working on some of your deficits and some of your weaknesses. That doesn't mean you give up your power and strength. Of course not. When you compete or you live your life, you're going to migrate towards your strength. Absolutely. I'm not saying give those up. I'm saying to become a more well-balanced athlete and human being and a healthier person, you should bring up some of those qualities that are not high. Like if I give myself like a 9 on power, like an 8 or 9 on power, maybe I'm like a 6 or 7 on strength. My endurance is like a 2 and my mobility is like a 2 or a 1. I'm pretty clear what I need to be working on. It's mobility. I'm kind of kicking myself in the pants here. Like I don't like flexibility and mobility work because I suck at it. I'm terrible.
Only because you're
so. What do I do? Yeah, I do sprinting. I do this. I do that. Yeah. Now, I wasn't naturally strong. I had to kind of bring up my strength levels over a couple of decades. But I think I took strength so far, and I took power out that now I'm good at slow strength training. But I'm depressed because I'm not powerful. Like I lost a lot of my speed and power. So now I'm backing off. See, my intention has changed. Now I want to bring back up my power. Let the strength kind of maintain. I'm not really chasing strength gains anymore because it's not really helping me.
Yeah.
There comes a point when a biomotor quality, just to blindly keep trying to expand the envelope, I think is actually detrimental. It may be your gift, but guess what? It may be your curse. Because now all of a sudden, all that strength you have, it glues you up, it binds you up, and you can't touch your toes. Or if you're in endurance and you can run 5 marathons in a row, but you have to sprint up a hill fast or jump from like a rock to another rock to get out of the way of a mountain lion, and you can't do it because you have no power. So we all have our strengths, but we all have our weaknesses.
Yeah,
so intentional athleticism is score yourself honestly, be intentional about balancing out your athletic profile. Right. Think of a portfolio. You have your own portfolio. I call it athletic portfolio. You have one. I have one.
Yep.
Just like a folder, open up that folder. Have you deposited anything into that folder lately? Right. And if I ask you, Josh, where do you think your strengths are? If you're to rate yourself, what are your top strengths?
That's a tough one. Right now, I'm going to be really harsh on myself and say nothing.
Nothing.
I'm terrible.
Dead.
No, you know what? I think I'm pretty good on movement wise. You know, I can do a good Astagrass squat. My movement quality is pretty good.
So your mobility is maybe like 7 or 8.
Yeah.
So it's high. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So maybe that goes in the maintenance mode for a bit, and you bring up some of your other deficits. What do you think? One, what do you think needs to be raised, and what would you like to get better at?
Strength, definitely like to get strength and power. I definitely like to increase. But on the flip side of that, I know I also need to work on my endurance as well. So those are probably my big things. With you know, different ends of the scale, strength, power, and endurance. But I definitely need to work on those qualities 100%.
Well, then there's a little template for it. You have a strength day, you have an endurance day, and you have a power day.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's going to be $500, Josh. No, I'm joking.
And that concludes the podcast today. Thank you so much, Franz.
Hey.
No, it is. It's something that I talked with Phil back on the very first episode of the podcast. And I think it is really, really good to go through that checklist and just score yourself, because you're like, oh, crap. I thought I was better at that. But now when I honestly look at it, I maybe need to back off on this and work on this. It's really, really good thing to do. So I highly recommend that. But you were saying that, I'm going to pick on you now, Franz, that you you said that you were maybe poor on the flexibility, or were you using that as an example?
No. I'm actually really, really poor. I go through periods of time where I work on it a little bit less, but I'm genetically very hardwired to be a little stiffer. I think that's actually why I was pretty good at sprinting, because I mean, my lower legs are stiff. My, you know, really loose, supple, loosey-goosey people, they tend not to be great sprinters, just because you need some stiffness in your tissues to transmit energy back up the entire kinetic chain.
To release that power.
Too much looseness is actually not good. You don't want to be that lax, and they can be quite dangerous. But on the flip side, you have me, which is I'm just like a, you know, like the Tin Man. It may help me in sprinting, maybe. But it sucks to live in that body.
Yeah.
Because then all of a sudden, I wake up and I can't touch my toes, and you just feel old, right? It's not a good feeling.
Absolutely. Because the reason I say this is because shoulder health and shoulder range of motion must be a pretty important quality when it comes to sprinting. So maybe that's something you need to work on, mate.
Dude, 1,000%. My shoulders are bound up, and my shoulders, the first, like I've recently really gotten back into sprinting, like for about 6 weeks after kind of a bad injury last year. So it's nice that I've been able to, you know, really be consistent with it. But my shoulders, they were really pissy in the beginning, because I didn't have the extension. Yeah. I just was so bound up in the front of my shoulder, my anterior shoulder, that I was lacking that extension where I kind of open up my elbow and hand as my arm goes in back of me. And it was bothering me. So I'm really, I've been doing a lot of kind of like crab crawl position, where I like bridge my hips up to try to loosen up that anterior shoulder. And I will say it's getting better. It's cool. Finally starting. Yeah, well, it's starting done. To get better. Well, but done. Yeah, but that's intentional athleticism in practice. Nice. I have to practice what I preach. My deficit is mobility and flexibility.
Yeah.
So I need to be very intentional about working on that. I'm already strong. I'm not strong compared to like a power lifter, but I don't need a stronger deadlift than I have. I mean, you just, there comes a point when chasing a motor quality just for ego, you're just like, what's the point?
Yeah.
I'm not a power lifter. Hey, man, I don't want to do
you're
it.
Pretty strong. I've witnessed you, you know, bottoms up press a pretty damn big kettlebell, mate. So you're not doing too bad.
No, I'm, you know what? I'm strong enough.
Yeah.
I'm strong enough, but I enjoy power and speed more than strength. So for me, strength is more just a means of just kind of making me a more well-rounded person in case I need to help you move your sofa or something. But I think everybody's got to follow what they enjoy too. Like, don't just do something, well, I suck at this and I'm just going to stick with this. No. Do what you love. You know, do what makes you feel alive.
100%.
But you're not going to be able to do what you love if you're jacked up and injured, because you just didn't work on your deficits.
Yeah, absolutely. So besides besides that crab that you talked about for your shoulders, what would be another couple of good drills for shoulder mobility in terms of sprinting?
There's a really good one. I put a couple of weeks on my Instagram account, and it's a standing drill where you basically, like, if you were to have like a barbell on a rack, and you got it maybe around shoulder height, and you were to stand in front of it with your back facing the bar, and you just reach back and try to get your hands fairly close together. And then just hang out there so your shoulder blades will naturally kind of come together, but you're going to stretch your anterior shoulder, your bicep, your forearms, your wrist. And it's like a hyper-focused stretch to get your arm in a extension pattern. And most people are going to really struggle with that.
Yeah.
So I think
well,
like
we all
that,
live, all crunched up and forward, don't we nowadays?
So yeah. So even just getting a stick and just like, even if you just do like some stick drills where you hold onto like a dowel rod and you move it from the front of your body to the back of your body, but really focusing on getting those arms and back you, and then gradually starting to narrow the grip where you bring your hands closer together. That's where most people are going to struggle. You're going to run into like, oh my God, like my shoulders. Don't overdo it. But, yeah, so anything that gets your arm into extension that allows you to maintain some integrity in your posture. And you know, if you're gritting your teeth and it looks like somebody squirted lemon juice in your eye, it's probably too much. Back off
a little bit, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're holding your breath, like, wait a second, back off. Make it easy.
Absolutely.
Gradually work into it.
What one of Perry's top cheats, holding your breath. Don't hold your breath, guys. No breath holding.
Yeah.
No. Right, mate. I prepped you for this right at the start. I want you to talk me through your superhero checklist of qualities and aptitudes, because you put this post out on Facebook the other day and I read it and I just thought it was fantastic. It's just something that everyone out there listening could and should be working on.
All right. You just want me to go through my top 10?
Yeah, absolutely. So I can read them out, and if you want to expand on them a little bit, or you can shoot straight on. Do you want me to read them out?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So the first one is ankle mobility. What's important about the ankles?
The ankles are the gateway to athleticism. And the older I get, the stiffer I notice that my ankles get, and a lot of my clients as well. But if you have powerful hips and a powerful core, and you're not able to move your ankle enough, you're going to lose the transference of energy from your toes and your feet up to your hips and vice versa. You're just not going to get it. And if you look at the best athletes in the world, you'll like somebody like Michael Jordan, I mean, or LeBron James. And if you're to look at the level of ankle mobility that they have when they're driving towards the basket, you know, they're like they're almost look like they're slalom skiing. But if you look at their feet, they have so much ability to move that lower leg, the tibia and the fibula, forward of a flat foot that, I mean, in order to have power, you need to stretch a muscle. If you cannot get your lower leg to come forward of your foot, like we're like literally where the knee will actually like go past your toes, you have no power. So really a lot of the power in your hips and glutes will get lost because you just don't have that ankle. So ankle mobility, dynamic ankle mobility and flexibility is the secret. Like it really is like you can have all this other stuff, but if you can't move your ankles, you're just not going to be powerful. So cool. You've got to work on ankle mobility. Have to.
Awesome.
Absolutely have to.
Hip flexion is the next one.
Yeah. So along that same theme of stretching and actually pre-stretching, in order for muscle to be powerful, you have to stretch it first. So think of, when you're in a sprint, or actually if you're distance running, you don't really need to lift your foot or knee off the ground that high because you're just not generating a lot of force. If you want to generate more force, think of the hammer analogy. If I have you hammer the nail from a quarter inch from the nail or 6 inches or a foot, what's going to be able to generate more force? The latter. So hip flexion is essential because when you bring your knee up in the air, in the running analogy, if you lift your foot high enough to stance knee, right? If you can think of running in knee-deep water, when you lift that foot high enough, that means you're flexing your hip. You have adequate stretching of the glute and hamstring, and that preloads it almost like a spring. So when you get that stretch, that pre-stretch, you have potential power. So if you can't flex your hip, you are not going to be able to use your glutes and hamstrings.
Cool.
So hip flexion, you're absolutely essential. If you're not running fast, we got to look at ankle mobility, and then we got to look at your hips. You don't need to have crazy hip flexion, but you have to have adequate hip flexion or kiss your hip extension goodbye.
Nice. Okay, next one. I love this. Strong as hell, not just normal, strong as hell anti-rotation.
Yeah, most power is going to be lost in rotation where people are just not able to check those forces when they rotate. And when you sprint or walk or gait, anything you do involves rotation in the core and your spine. It's always going to be rotating. There's no such thing as a stable, like non-moving core that's complete rubbish. It's always moving a bit. But if it moves excessively, you're leaking power. We call it linkage versus leakage. You don't want to leak energy. So anti-rotation movements will teach your brain that when you move your arms and legs, you should be able to check that core, the obliques and the back and the abdominals, and a lot of these muscles that attach to the rib and pelvis. They have to be able to check forces, because if you're rotating too much, especially when you sprint, you're just leaking energy in the transverse plane, which means that you're not going to run in a straight line. That you're just, so you're basically like wobbling instead of just trying to keep things in check. Yep. So anti-rotation is huge. You can think of things like the renegade row or single arm rows in a push-up position, single arm push-ups, the like payoff press with a stretch band, anything that allows you to move your limbs without moving the core or without moving your spine. You just minimize the movement there. That's anti-rotation, essential.
Fantastic. Next one is Big Toe Mojo. You've stolen that from Dr. Perry.
Yes, I did. I love that guy. He's a genius. So yeah, basically, if you can't extend your big toe, energy leakage. You're going to compensate. And there's three phases of running, definitely of sprinting. You have kind of this initial impact, which in walking, we'll just call it heel strike. And then when your whole foot comes to the ground, that's your stance phase. But then you have a propulsion phase where you actually toe off when your foot's in back of you. And that should be done from the big toe. And if you cannot extend that big toe from that first metatarsal, you will compensate. You'll flip your foot out. You'll flip the foot in. You will collapse somewhere else to get the hip to extend. But you will leak energy. And it's actually, you're just going to beat up your back. Because most people that can't extend their toe, they have to make up that extension somewhere. Like all of these muscles that work with extension, the big toe, the hip, the back, they're all part of the same team. But because the big toe is the first point of impact for propulsion, if you lose that, you just hyperextend your back, and then you underuse your glutes and hamstrings, back injury. You're not using your glutes. You're not using your hamstrings. So you've got to try to get that big toe to work in conjunction with the hip and the back.
Cool. Work on that.
Work it every day. Yeah.
Big toe mojo.
Yeah, every day.
Cool. The next one is shoulder extension, which I've kind of covered. I think we covered that before, so we'll move on. The next one after that is rate of force development.
So we talked about shoulder extension. That's important. Rate of force development is basically, if you can think a deadlift, right? You get a deadlift. Let's say you're lifting a 400-pound deadlift. It takes you 15 seconds to get it up off the ground. That's strong, but that's not power. The rate of force development is slow. Whereas if you jump from, let's say, a boulder 5 feet to another boulder over, that rate of force development is very high, and that is what we're after. So rather than just lifting for the sake of strength, if you can lift 400 pounds in 1 second, your rate of force development is much higher than if you lift it in 15 seconds. Mm. So sprinting is the ultimate rate of force development, jumping, skipping, things where you actually move your body very, very fast. Mm. That is huge. So do fast stuff.
Awesome. And that's where you wrote the that quote from the Chicago Bulls guy: train slow, be slow, train fast, be fast. I knew I'd seen it somewhere. Fantastic. Right, next one, anti-extension.
Yeah, so extension and flexion are part of the normal movement of the spine. But most sprinters and a lot of athletes tend to live in extension. Like they kind of have like this tilted forward hyperlordotic posture where they kind of have like this tight back and tight hip flexors, but kind of like a loose abdomen. And that lends itself to a host of problems, hamstring strains, and mainly hamstring strains, because as your pelvis dips forward, you're putting the hamstrings under stretch. Mm. And muscles do not like to be lengthened like that for long periods of time, especially when you're running or jumping or sprinting. So the exercises where you kind of teach your body to keep a little bit more of a kind of a neutral pelvis, again, there's no like perfect like spine position or pelvic position. It doesn't exist. But teaching people to not overdo extension, because most people, if they lack extension in their big toe or in their in their hips, they'll just make up for it in their back. So if you can come up with some cool exercises where you force the hip to move without the back moving too much, And this is where anti-extension kind of gets a little bit confused with some of the anti-rotation as well. But very important to learn how to kind of check that extension. Extension's normal on the back. You just don't want excessive extension. So doing some anti-extension exercises are huge, absolutely huge.
Fantastic. Next one. This is very much a given, but thoracic spine mobility.
Yeah. I mean, that's where most of the movement, if you actually look at the facet joints, which are the joints that you move on in your spine, the lumbar joints are very concave. They're like, they're not really designed for more than about 5 to 7 degrees of rotation. And you look at the thoracic joints, they're smooth and they're designed for rotation. So that's where the body is designed to rotate from. And if you don't rotate well from there, you're going to overuse your low back and your neck, and then you get problems. So you really want to be, if you can encourage more mobility, be intentional about getting the mobility in your thoracic spine and getting less range of motion in your lumbars and your lower cervicals, you're just going to have a healthier spine. So most people need to work on this daily. I mean, not, you know, just a little bit every day will go a long way. So a lot of the joint mobility stuff that's out there, you know, where you're kind of crawling and doing like, you know, these openers with your arms and you're like that stuff is gold. Yeah. That stuff is fantastic.
Just a few minutes every day. Fantastic. Cool. Yeah, I'm going to mix the last two together. It is stronger psoas and bigger and stronger hip extensors, glutes and hamstrings.
Yeah. So I think the psoas has been kind of demonized as this horrible muscle, but it's not. It's a huge player in athleticism and in health. It's a huge stabilizer, but dynamically, it's a power muscle. It helps you with your abs contract the front side of your body, which is the secret to using the back side of your body. So if you want to use your glutes and hamstrings and calves and all that stuff, you need to make sure that your hip flexor is strong and has endurance and it's got some muscle in it. So you can have a tight, weak psoas. I'd rather just have a strong psoas. So doing some psoas work is really good, or just intentional about when you do your lifting that you're really engaging your psoas. Like on squatting, for example, just use your psoas as you pull yourself into a squat, and then doing like even some isolation work. I'm not anti-isolation work. You can do some good band work around your foot just to really work on hip flexion. Like people need to be stronger in hip flexion, and then hip extensors, glutes, hamstrings, like that. That's power. Once you can flex your hip, then you got to extend your hip, and that's it. Sprinting, deadlifting, squatting, I'm all for that. And you know, if you're fitting into normal blue jeans, you're probably not a strength and power athlete. So,
absolutely. Well, as you said, the psoas, it's often tight and weak, not necessarily tight and strong. So you need to work on those psoas, guys. So that's it. That is, as Fran says in his post, that is the blueprint for old guy or woman power and a better life. I love that post, mate. It's absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
No worries. Franz, we've been jibber-jabbering on for, an hour now. I can't believe how quick that's gone. However, before I let you go, I'm going to throw a quick lightning round at you, mate, and see how your knowledge of sprinting is. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
What is the current 100-meter men's world record?
It is 9.58.
I was going to say, you are so wrong. 9.58. Sorry. Absolutely. By who and in what year?
Usain Bolt. And that was, I believe it was World Championships.
You know what?
You know what? I'm.
I forgot to write the answer to that one down.
Oh, you did?
I think it was. It might be. Was it 2012? 13? I don't know.
Well, 2012 was London Olympics. You know what? I'm embarrassed to say I don't know. It was either at the World Championships in 2009, I believe. It could have been. Or it could have been at the 2008.
I think you're right in 2009. We're going to go with that. What is the current women's 100-meter world record?
It's Florence Griffith Joyner, FloJo. That would have been an 80. Oh my God. I think 86 or 87, something like that.
Oh, you're so close. 88.
Oh, darn it. And I think it's a 10.41, 10.42.
Ooh, 10.49, man. You are good.
Yeah,
good.
I'm close.
The first person to break the 10-second barrier?
That I don't know.
That was a guy called Jim Hines in the 1968 Olympics.
I know who Jim Hines is, but I didn't know he was the first guy to break 10.
Yeah, by all accounts, he was. Last one, mate. Who would win in a race between Usain Bolt or a cheetah?
Probably the cheetah.
It was indeed. An 11-year-old cheetah named Sarah clocked 61 miles per hour, covering 100 meters in 5.95 seconds. So well done, Sarah. Franz, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Thank you so much for taking your time out to come and speak to me on the Everyday Athlete podcast. You enjoyed it?
Oh, so much fun. I'm excited that this is up and running, and I can't wait to just hear the other awesome guests you guys have.
Thank you so much. Guys, if you want to find out more about Franz and everything he does, you can go to www.revolutionlahoya.com or his Primal Speed, which is www.primalspeed.com. You can find him on Instagram, Franz Schneiderman, or Twitter, at Franz Schneiderman. Thank you so much, mate. What have you got planned for the rest of your day?
I think I've got another phone call and hang out with the kids and get ready for the Primal Speed Challenge tomorrow. We have a power challenge tomorrow, four events. So that'll be another call.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. Good luck with the Primal Speed Challenge. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you guys for tuning in. Until next time. Fantastic stuff there from Franz. Thank you so much, mate. And if you're not already, I hope that episode encourages you to introduce a little bit of sprint training into your workout regime. In next week's episode, I have the absolute pleasure of speaking to world-renowned back specialist Dr. Stuart McGill. I promise you, this is an episode not to be missed, so tune in next time for that, guys. In the meantime, before we go, I just want to say get yourself onto the App Store or Google Play or any of the platforms that I may not have mentioned and download the Strength Matters app, where you can access all of our podcasts and our fantastic blog, of course, as well as our Strength Matters magazine. Thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time.
Thanks for joining us on the Everyday Athlete podcast. Be sure to check back next week for another exciting episode. For a full breakdown of every show and links to resources mentioned, head on over to our website, www.realstrengthmatters.com. Seek adventure. Be curious. Train with purpose. #EverydayAthlete.